The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, for years, many traditional financial companies were a bit skeptical and cautious when it came to cryptocurrencies. But that's all changed. And in the last few years, some of the most important trading firms have started to make big investments in the space. And not just to trade Bitcoin and Ether and all the other digital assets, but to actually play a role in building out the infrastructure that connects these global decentralized markets together. We're going to talk to the president of a trading firm that has taken a big plunge into crypto about what they're up to and where they see the industry going next. But Valdana, before we bring him in, I've got a bit of a bone to pick with you in that I was going through the brackets on the Bloomberg terminal. You know, if listeners aren't familiar, you can enter an NCAA bracket right on the terminal.
Right.
You did not enter a bracket. I'm very disappointed.
I didn't. I know nothing about March Madness.
But
zero
that's what,
things.
That's exactly, you're exactly the type of person who wins these things, though, then. You know,
that's
the rest
true,
of us,
yeah.
We think we're a bunch of geniuses. We pick all the upsets. For you, you know, you could look at it like, oh, they gave me the answers. I'll take 1 over 16 and 2 over 15.
Although my track record with this type of stuff is so bad, as you know, and let the listeners know, I asked you, who should I be betting on? And you never gave me any answers, so I have nobody to cheer for.
I did tell you to bet on the Delaware Blue Hens, and that was probably not,
yeah,
not my
wisest
call.
Yeah, that was not a good call. Not a good call at all.
I should have said St. Peter's and Jersey City, the true Cinderella.
Right.
So.
Yeah, from our native New Jersey. Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, I want to bring in our guest. His name is Dave Olson. He's the president and chief investment officer of Jump Trading Group. Dave, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Valdana. Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Dave. And Dave, I can only imagine if you put some of that brain power at Jump Trading to work on the brackets. I'm just throwing that out there. You know, Jump Trading and bracketology. You guys could be onto something there. But why don't you talk to us a little bit? Let the listeners know about your background. I know you came from a long career at J.P. Morgan to Jump. Jump was a computerized trading firm in derivatives and a lot of asset classes. You've sort of made that migration into crypto in recent years. Talk us through sort of the history of your career and how Jump got involved in crypto.
Yeah, sure. So quite right. I was at JP Morgan for about 25 years. I had a chance over that span to work in a lot of different areas of the bank. The bank changed a lot. I think it was about 5,500 employees when I joined
wow.
in the corporate finance training program. And I think when I left, it was something like 270,000. So nothing like the merger and getting into the retail business to amp those numbers up. It was a terrific place to be right in the middle of a lot of the inner workings of finance and the global developments. You know, the derivatives market grew a lot while I was there. I was involved in those markets quite a bit. I did some fintech venture capital work around Web 1.0. We didn't call it that back then, but the dot-com days. And then the last several years of my career, I spent running the clearing businesses and got to know a lot of the quantitative trading firms and got to know more about Jump. And it was a natural progression to to be able to work for a company like Jump that I had seen handle a lot of volatile markets, a lot of tough decisions, and really got to know them at least from the outside before I had an interest in coming over. It was actually shortly after I started at Jump that we started to scale into crypto. I joined Jump in 2016. Starting in around 2015, we had been incubating an experiment with a group of students at University of Illinois. They had come to work in a laboratory that we had set up in conjunction with the computer science and computer engineering departments there. And crypto was really a frontier back then. There were no organized exchanges to speak of. There were a lot of homegrown solutions to liquidity in the crypto markets. We were interested in it, and it fit a really nice spot to work on with this group of students and interns where we wouldn't expose a lot of intellectual property of the company. There wasn't much to trade in crypto. Bitcoin was still under $1,000. Ether had not traded even one coin yet. So this is pretty early days. And as an exercise, several of the Jump Labs students and employees set about the work of building a really high performance infrastructure, almost as a proving ground to trade crypto for the first time. It's never something you would have invested in as a business plan kind of matter. There wasn't enough volume. The risks were too high. There were a whole litany of problems in solving the post-trade and movement of fiat. But as an exercise, it was great. And it was just very fortunate timing that at the end of it, we had really a world-class infrastructure ready to go as soon as Bitcoin started to lift off in terms of both price action and volumes. So that was really the genesis of how we got involved.
It's so interesting to hear this backstory, because I actually wanted you to talk about what building that crypto infrastructure actually looks like, what it entails. And then correct me if I'm wrong, but the crypto division, the Jump crypto division, you announced that officially last year, right? And so what do your goals look like in terms of how large of a player you want to be in the crypto space?
Yeah. So a bunch in that question. The early days of connectivity were wild and woolly. I think one of the coolest thing about being a participant in the crypto markets is we are interacting with really bright, really talented people, many of whom have had no exposure to finance whatsoever. They might be cryptographers. They might be a couple of guys in Slovenia that ran a computer parts repair store that were mining Bitcoin after hours on the rigs that people had brought in to fix. And all of them had come at similar problems with a totally fresh perspective. And you know, that leads to a lot of idiosyncrasies in how a matching engine works, or where the data center is hosted, or how the cloud is used. So we really had our first opportunity to do sophisticated quantitative trading in the cloud because of crypto. So that was, you know, and now that is starting to bleed into a lot of other areas of finance. And, we'll see where it goes from here. That was a big topic at the Futures Industry Association annual meetings, which took place last week. Crypto is really on the front edge of that, because there's not a lot of baggage with how things have always worked or what the cookie cutter approach is to building something in finance. That's a very, very fun. That's a very fun part of it. So you're right. Crypto did start as combination of a skunk works stroke experiment. Also, I think we were careful in the early years to not tip our hand to the market that we were investing as much as we were in crypto. It was still relatively greenfield. There were still a lot of first mover advantage out there. So we were very tight-lipped externally, for sure. Even internally, we didn't promote or publicize too much. And we had a pretty small team working on things for the first couple of years. But as it started to scale, so 2017, when it hit 10,000 in Bitcoin for the first time, and through the crypto winter that ensued in 2018, and then kind of the grind up from there, we've been constantly investing. We've been adding talent. We've become a pretty big part of the marketplace, not only trading, that's where our heritage is, But we've become a pretty big venture capital investor in the infrastructure that we see as necessary to have crypto and DeFi flourish. And really starting in the last couple of years, a lot of our focus has moved to building. So we've hired a lot of blockchain engineering talent. We acquired a firm called Certus One. We believe to be the best blockchain engineers in the world. We were able to acquire, and we've been adding to that team. So all told, we're well over 100 people in Jump Crypto. It is its own business unit. It's part of Jump Trading Group, but run really as a separate enterprise and continues to scale pretty substantially.
I find it fascinating that the origins date back to the University of Illinois. You know, it used to be back in the day, you try to hire the smartest coming out of undergrads or coming out of grad school. Now you go right to the school. I think I'm going to go back to college, maybe get another degree. I don't know.
Get a fun internship.
Get that internship. Get on the ground floor. But Dave, I want to talk about some of the infrastructure projects. Obviously, one big one that you guys are heavily involved in is what's known as Wormhole. And correct me if I'm butchering the explanation of this, but the way I understand it, it's basically a bridge that lets you take assets trading on the Solana blockchain and carry them over the bridge, which is Wormhole, onto the Ethereum blockchain. So that there's sort of connectivity between the two blockchains. Obviously something, a month or two ago went horribly wrong. Someone was able to figure out a software exploit, on the bridge and, basically take, 300 million worth of Ether, and sort of disappear. Walk us through exactly what happened there and sort of how Jump was involved, not only with the development of Wormhole, but this whole escapade and how you guys came sort of to the rescue of the project at the end.
Yeah, you're right. I think your description of Wormhole being a cross-chain bridge is dead on. I think the way I think of it in an analogy that I think of when describing Wormhole is, let's say I've got a PayPal account and I go out to dinner with some friends. And if they're all using PayPal, we're on kind of the same quote layer one payment system. And it's very easy for us to settle the bill or pay each other for the cab fare or whatever's going on. But if one of us uses the Cash App or Venmo or some other payment mechanism and I don't, there's no way that I can communicate at all. They're just completely separate ecosystems. They're closed off from one another. You can't pay $20 from PayPal into the Cash App. You have to either have them download the app, which is a big pain, or heaven forbid. Okay,
by the way, that's usually me when I'm out to dinner with a big group. I'm like, sorry guys, I got the app. None of you guys use. I'll get the next one. All right, it's going to catch up with me someday.
Sign the check on the dashboard of the car. I'll be out in the parking lot doing that. For a long time, that's how the blockchain world worked. If you had Ether on the Ethereum network and you were using that layer one blockchain, you had this very vibrant community. There were smart contracts written. There were NFT platforms. You could do a lot with your Ether. But if you wanted to spend that Ether or get yourself involved in a project or buy an NFT on a different chain, you either had to convert downstream into fiat and then reload a different wallet and have different providers. It was very clunky. So Wormhole isn't really linked to any one specific chain. So the only thing I would take issue with your description is there are now 8 layer ones. It's totally interoperable. We expect that number to grow well into double digits by the end of the year. There's a new layer one being added every couple of weeks or so. If you've got Ether and you wanted to move that Ether to the Oasis network or Terra or Solana or Binance Smart Chain or a bunch of different chains out there, you've got the ability to do that pretty easily. And important to note, it's not just token movement. So this could be NFTs, this could be messages, it could be data, really anything that can exist on any of those blockchains can be ported over through Wormhole to another blockchain. Importantly, it's not a hub and spoke model. So let's say that you moved Ether over to Solana and then you wanted to move that wrapped Ethereum over to Terra. You don't have to go back all the way through all the hops back to the home chain and then start back up. You can just move straight from one to the other. So a lot of functionality there. We first got involved. Actually, I've already mentioned Certus One. They were the group writing the first lines of code to develop Wormhole, and it's one of the elements that attracted us to that team. And the community started to rally around the idea of a cross-chain bridge. We're very enthusiastic about it, so we became sponsors and backers, and wrote code and tried to evangelize its use to the best we could. It is a decentralized project, so you know it's out there and is a community effort. But we've had a pretty high share of some of the early work that went into the thinking. One of the reasons why we've got such conviction in a cross-chain world is there's a lot of creativity happening with layer ones right now. Some are really well designed for one attribute. Let's say extremely high throughput, very high performance. You know, that's Solana right now is leading the layer one pack in terms of transactions per second and low gas fees. That's very well suited for some areas that start to bleed into what looks more like traditional finance. And then you've got the Ethereum blockchain, which has got this incredible community of passionate developers that are writing smart contracts and creating NFT marketplaces and things like that. And our firmly held belief is that the future is a multi-layer one future, and that the comparative advantage of the different attributes of layer ones is something that should be celebrated and that we would expect to continue to scale. So, you know, right now, if you're an artist and you wanted to sell NFTs, Ethereum is where there is the most liquidity. It's where the biggest community for NFTs exists. But it's also one of the most expensive places to mint a new series of NFTs. So now you don't have to force fit yourself into doing everything on one layer one. If you wanted to mint on a much more efficient home layer one blockchain, you could pay much lower gas fees. Importantly to a lot of artists, and certainly to me, you can use a much lower energy footprint. And then you've minted 1,000 NFTs. If you wanted to move a dozen of those, your most rare copies over into OpenSea, you can use Wormhole to do that, and you kind of get the best of both worlds. So that's some background on what Wormhole is and why we're so excited about it. And quite right, in February, we had it just so happened that about 24 of us at Jump Crypto were down in Miami. We were in some rented office space. We were spending time together, going through our plans for the year, doing some deep dive on research, debating white papers, you know, figuring out where we wanted to build next. And in the middle of the afternoon, one of our team members who watches a lot of things that are happening on the blockchain like a hawk noticed that there started to become a discrepancy between the amount of wrapped ETH, so the amount of Ethereum that should have had a one-for-one deposit locked in a smart contract on the Ethereum blockchain, those numbers didn't match anymore. So he pressed the proverbial big red button. We all happened to be in a tiny, tiny little room together, and we immediately identified that there was an issue. You know, the way I've described it to people is it's basically a high tech check forgery, where the attacker or attackers were able to spoof the destination chain. In this case, that was Solana, into believing that Ether had been locked up on the Ethereum blockchain. So they were able to kind of print out of thin air some new wrapped ETH. Once you've got wrapped Ether, you can do a couple things. You can go back kind of to the cashier stand and say, okay, I've got this wrapped ETH. I'd like to turn it in for the original ETH, please. And because of the way the system worked, that other Ether that had been locked previously was made available to that person tendering the wrapped ETH. And you can buy stuff with wrapped ETH on different chains. So a little bit happened of the second one, a lot happened of the first one, and all told, about 120,000 Ether was compromised. Our first step was to try to bring the system down. One of the trade-offs of a decentralized world is you know, you can't kick the plug out of the wall like you could if it was all your own. You have to put the word out into the community. The way Wormhole works, there are 19 guardians that attest to the transactions, and they're all independent. So we had to get the word out in the Wormhole community that there was an attack, and we needed to bring the system down. That probably took 20 minutes, I would guess. It was a tense 20 minutes because obviously the vulnerability still existed, and you know, there was more value locked beyond what had been compromised. And then the next step was, okay, what happened? And is it over? Like, have we effectively taken everything down? Do we know the totality of the problem? And then what caused it? What was the root issue that was able to be exploited? And can we fix it in a way that's totally robust? In parallel, we had to make the determination, okay, what do we do about the stolen stuff? You know, do we, you know, we don't have any Jump trading group. Jump Crypto doesn't have any contractual responsibilities. We're not liable for anything, but we made an elective decision to swiftly make all the participants whole and to go out and acquire 120,000 ETH ourselves, and then inject that 120,000 ETH into the Wormhole smart contract to replenish what the attacker had stolen.
And let me just butt in to say, yeah, you know, if for listeners not familiar with the price of ETH, you're talking about $3,000 roughly a token at that time, right? Something. So talking about what? Yeah, $300 million.
It was around $325 million that we wow. had to spend to do that. Yeah.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I feel like when someone pulls off a caper like this in crypto, eventually they get caught. It might not be right away, but, you know, was that in everyone's mind at all? Like, you know, we can make everyone whole in this project, but we're going to find whoever did this eventually and recoup at least some of that. You know, is that part of the thinking that motivates you to sort of come to the rescue for a project like this?
You know, you don't know what is going to happen at the end of all the paths that you chase down. All we know is we're going to chase down every path. We're working in very close consultation with government resources, with private resources. There is a lot of firepower that is expert at tracking down criminals like this. And we are in this fight permanently. So this is not something that we will become distracted by next month or next year or whenever. This is a permanent condition. But I would say that didn't really factor into the question as to what our action should be in the moment. That was really motivated by a belief that not doing so would have been an enormous setback to a cross-chain world in crypto and DeFi in general. quite logically, it may have been the end of Wormhole entirely. And that kind of a setback at this moment when such exciting foundational technology is being laid down would have been a terrible outcome, not just for the marketplace. And, you know, we're community minded for sure, but this wasn't totally an act of altruism. You know, this was an investment in what we believe is going to be an incredibly robust future for a lot of other projects that we're working on, investments that we've made, coins that we hold, just the entire scaling of a lot of DeFi capabilities, we think Wormhole is going to be central to. So whether or not we ever recoup the money or what we do with the Ether if we get it back wasn't really top of mind in thinking about it.
It was more about this event could have blown up all your future ambitions and goals, I guess.
Yeah. And look, you don't know where these coins are. You don't know who the attacker is, what type of attacker it is. They're just too many uncertainties, especially as it's unfolding, to try to handicap, you know, chance of success of trying to recoup it.
You already started answering part of my next question, which is, I wanted to ask you who exactly you're working with in terms of recovering the funds, and then how close are you to recovering them?
Well, you are quite a distance away from recovering the funds until you have them. So there's two states of the world. The agencies of the U.S. government are both incredibly engaged and incredibly well-resourced and expert. This is thankfully not something that we've had a lot of repetitions doing. So this is a little bit of a learning experience for everybody at Jump that has been involved in the pursuit of what's going on. But I've been terribly impressed by the resources within the U.S. government to go after these type of criminals. It's obviously a big number. It comes at a time when hacking is at the top of the consciousness of government and private industry. It also happened to occur just a few days before the Bitfinex successful capture was announced. So that timing was not only great because it made us feel good, like, okay, there's precedent for success here. But I think also is motivating for the government agencies that are involved in the hunt, that this is not a waste of time. You know, it's not necessarily a cold case that you're never going to go anywhere with. And I also think that case showed just how hard it is to move illicit funds around if they're in crypto form. You know, the Bitfinex attackers, you know, it was reported that they were resorting to trying to spend, what was it, $4.5 billion, $100 at a time with Walmart gift cards. You know, like, that is not a scaled solution. And, you know, the great thing about crypto is it's a permanent, immutable movement by movement record that is available for everyone to see. The Ether that was stolen in the Wormhole attack has made exactly one move into the wallet that it was moved into. It has not moved since. Everybody is watching that wallet. Every big exchange and stablecoin provider was fantastic in their response. That was something that happened minutes after we knew that the money had moved. We called and blacklisted those wallet addresses. Everyone just dropped everything and blacklisted them, except for one pretty big provider who, for understandable reasons, I suppose, said, "Listen, we need either a court order or a police report to blacklist wallets. We can't just have somebody call up and, you know, blacklist a wallet." And so we looked at each other, and one of the folks in the room, a pretty senior person at Jump, walked out of the office building into Miami and found the closest police precinct to where we were, and walked in middle of the afternoon, walked into the police precinct and said, the officer behind the desk looks up and says, "Yeah." And he says, "Yeah, I'd like to report a theft." And the officer nods and he goes, "Cell phone." I goes, nope. $320 million of wrapped ether. It's like the worst day this cop has seen behind a desk. And
that's fantastic.
You know, we got the, maybe this is better for Chicago to sort of fill out this paperwork. But, you know, God bless him. We got the police report and went on our way. So a lot of weird stuff like that.
That's amazing story. Well, Dave, you have my word that it wasn't me, okay? I promise you I wouldn't know how to even begin to do this. I don't know about Veldana. She is mysteriously in a condo in Florida now all of a sudden.
Veldana, there is a $10 million bounty if it is Mike that you want to give him up. We can talk later.
$10 million bounty. Wow, that's amazing. So all eyes just glued to that wallet forevermore, I guess. It'd be fascinating to see how that turns out. Dave, I wanted to ask about another one of sort of the infrastructure projects that you guys are very heavily involved with, and that's Pith. For listeners who aren't familiar, Pith is basically, I kind of think of it as the SIP, you know, the stock market SIP, which is basically just a data feed of all the trades that have happened that's available to all market participants. And obviously with crypto, it's much more complicated than that. There's everything from derivatives to crypto trades to I guess, equity and currency trades on it. But I want you to tell us a little bit about that. But I'm also curious how both Wormhole and Pith, to me, have some common motivation. And that's that you're trying to sort of solve problems that seem to originate with Ethereum. And the fact that it can kind of be sort of slow, you know, it's obviously the newer blockchain after Bitcoin, but compared to some of the more faster ones that have been developed since then, it's got this very dedicated community, as you pointed out, of developers building projects on top of it. It's got this core audience, but I can't help but wonder if, you know, having to develop these, you know, type of solutions for Ethereum problems, if in your mind that sort of bodes poorly for the long-term future of Ethereum. You know, is it, you know, to use sort of a tortured analogy, is it kind of putting, you know, a new radiator and slick tires on an old Subaru when really, you know, you're waiting for that Tesla to arrive? You know, is there a Solana or a more advanced blockchain that really eventually will be able to do everything on, you can do it on Ethereum just better, and that, you know, Ethereum's kind of doomed as a result? Is that too sort of pessimistic towards Ethereum to think of it that way?
You're right on the score that a lot of the motivations for what we build are driven by problems or inefficiencies in the marketplace that we think have got a big addressable market, and the building blocks of using crypto and blockchain tools are really well suited to solve. But you know, the way I think of Pith especially is it's because of Ethereum's success that the motivation for Pith really started. I think that the development of smart contracts and the types of creativity that you see, you know, we've used the analogy before, but it really does feel like the App Store moment for finance, that instead of having to wait for, you know, a big software company to figure everything out and release it, you can have a small number of folks in a garage or a living room or the basement or something like that come up with a great idea, start coding it, and then release it into a very welcoming environment. So I think that the success of Ethereum is a necessary condition for something like Pith to exist. And I go back to the comparative advantage idea that there are a lot of features with Ethereum that are terrific, that are going to endure, that are going to be part of this marketplace, I think, for a very long time. There are going to be other ones, you know, the way the Oasis layer one handles privacy and the ability to interact and do research on data in a partitioned way without exposing that data to the public blockchain. Very cool. Very different than a lot of other layer ones. The speed of Solana and the low cost. So I think we see a multi-chain opportunity for Pith. It's really the distribution of high fidelity market data that comes from the firsthand knowledge of having executed the trade or been the matching engine where the trade has taken place. And then, you know, instead of a top-down approach, which has traditionally been how market data has been distributed in finance. This is really bottoms up. So these are the risk takers, the participants that have that were there at the moment that the trade was consummated, being a beacon to say, hey, you know, we think the price of Ether is, you know, 3103, or we think the price of Tesla is 1,000, or the, you know, dollar yen is trading at 120, or whatever the instrument happens to be. You've got now more than 50 firsthand data participants all streaming that into a arbitration engine on the chain and then feeding that out to anybody who wants to take it. It's a pretty radical change in the way data is distributed.
Dave, I have one more question, sort of a bigger picture question that actually one of our colleagues sent over to me, Emily Nicole in London. She covers crypto and she's been following your story and writing a lot about Wormhole. And she was wondering if the kind of contingency planning that or making everybody whole, is that the type of contingency planning that anybody in your type of role in crypto should be thinking about? And is there sort of is that a dystopian way to be thinking about it?
You know, we've seen in traditional finance and in DeFi and in crypto, you know, even the original Ether hack, where the Ethereum blockchain had to react very quickly. These are realities. You know, the Equifax hack, there are reasonably sophisticated code bases that harden over time. And part of the way they harden is by finding their vulnerabilities when you go from a few hundred people reviewing the code and looking for problems to a few million people where there are very high stakes to and very high values associated with vulnerabilities. And that's how they get identified sometimes. So I think that's a reality, whether you're on-chain or off-chain or in a big company or in a hacker house or no matter where you are. That's kind of the progression that complex software has to go through. You know, you're hopeful you don't have to do too many iterations of that. You know, we mentioned a couple minutes ago the $10 million bounty for the return of the hacked Wormhole funds or the conviction of the perpetrators. We've also got a $10 million bug bounty for finding new unrelated bugs where you can be a white hat hacker, not be chased, you know, by governments around the world the rest of your life, but get an eight-figure payoff from finding a critical vulnerability that's out there. So I think, you know, it wasn't the first time we had thought of how we would react when something went wrong. It wasn't that afternoon when we discovered the Wormhole exploit. You do contingency plan for that sort of thing. You know, you hope it doesn't happen. And if it does, you hope it's not of that magnitude. But thankfully we had the financial resources and the conviction to react immediately when it did. But I don't think it's dystopian at all. I think it's pragmatic and realistic that you got to think that way.
Kind of trial under fire, you know. Well, I'll say if any listeners know where all that stolen Ether is, tweet to Vildana and I. We'll get you that $10 million. I'm not even going to ask for a cut of it, Dave.
We can split it.
Yeah,
right. We can split it.
10% agency fee. That's what they use.
Yeah, something like that.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY.
Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Dave, I wanted to sort of ask you a big picture question about sort of the state of the world and how crypto fits into it. Obviously, boy, the world really changed about a month ago with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the financial sanctions that came as a result from the U.S. and its allies. A lot of people sort of talking about, well, are these oligarchs using crypto to hide their money? It's also sort of, I think, put some urgency behind the idea of central bank digital currencies, at least, you know, people thinking about, well, you know, should China make the digital ECNY something that can be used internationally? Would a digital ruble allow Russia to get out of, you know, around some of these sanctions? And to me, you know, when you get back to the idea of like, well, are sort of the sanctioned Russians trying to hide out in crypto? To me, that actually goes to one of the sort of, you know, main fundamental selling points of crypto, getting around that financial censorship that a lot of people think is important. But at the same time, I feel like it's also the biggest risk to crypto if, you know, that type of thing is being done on scale that, you know, the government regulators could really sort of crack down a lot harder and a lot faster than maybe they would otherwise with regulations. How are you thinking sort of the state of crypto given all these crazy current events that we've seen? You know, is it, you know, is this a danger from the regulatory side to crypto, or is it, does it help it evolve into sort of the more mature version of the industry? You know, what's it all mean to you?
Dave, I give you props if you followed any of that all the way through yeah. and you actually know what the question is.
I've got a sentence diagram like we used to do in grammar school. Dave followed all of it.
Yeah, it's like when you go to the doctor and they say three words and they ask you to repeat the three words at the end of it.
And we'll see how I do.
Yeah. So I think, first things first, I think I can't imagine a worse tool for an oligarch to try to siphon money out of a bank account or a sanctioned country than crypto. You know, we talked about the Bitfinex hackers having to resort to $100 Walmart gift cards. You know, if you've got a couple $1,000 and you want to sneak around in crypto, you know, you might get lost in the sea. If you've got 50 million, and this is not oligarch money or sovereign state money we're talking about, that these $50 million is a lot of money. It is tiny compared to the billions that are at issue with sanctions. There's nowhere to go. Like, there is no off ramp that you can find to liquidate a crypto asset into something usable in the real world. You're stuck. You know, firms like Chainalysis and a lot of other private companies are getting better and better and better at identifying the provenance of each coin's movements, where it came from, what the on-ramp was, where the off-ramp's going. You've got all the eyes in the world on it, and it's totally public. You know, I don't know a good way to evade sanctions. Hopefully there are none, but I would imagine that crypto has to rank among the worst possible ways. I will say for the record, Jump Capital, Jump Crypto, and Jump Trading Group are not involved in Monero. You know, there are some coins designed to specifically elude the types of analysis that we're talking about. We've not traded one Monero coin in our history. We've made a conscious decision not to. We don't want to be a conduit for something that would, veer into that territory, even if permitted by rule or regulation. So we're very much on the side of a transparent blockchain model that authorities can use to hunt down bad guys and bring them to justice or enforce sanctions. So I'm much more in the camp that this will be an educational moment for the market, that crypto is not some, you know, netherworld back alley where you can't see what's going on and billions of dollars can move and no one knows where they are. You know exactly where they are. And there's just no liquidity to get off the bus. It's maybe Speed 3 can be the sequel that Sandra Bullock is looking for trying to find a crypto off ramp, but it's not out there.
Yeah. How about the idea of CBDCs? I mean, does this this whole financial sanctions environment sort of do you think it'll hasten the development of CBDCs? And how do you see them fitting in to the crypto world? Are they just a completely different beast? Or are they in some ways, could they be a competitor to crypto? You know, at least in terms of just the efficiency of a digital currency versus the old fiat currency?
You know, I think that there'll be another tool in the toolbox, but it would be a big deal if a major sovereign nation decided to take their central bank currency digital. Crypto has got a lot of elements that make it really well designed for the way global commerce works, for the way trading and markets work. You know, we've seen the introduction of 24/7 markets at scale really for the first time with crypto. Banking is not 24/7, so there's a little bit of a disconnect there, and that's one of the reasons why stablecoins have come to such prominence, is that they're immediately available and liquid no matter what hour of the day it is, without the, you know, the Fed wire being up or the Bank of Japan being open for business or whatever you're trying to do. So I think that some of the elements that crypto is well designed for, a central bank digital currency would be fantastic. You know, it would be great to have a digital dollar that you could use for settlements at any moment, any time throughout the day, without regard to which bank you're banking at. You can do that in kind of limited scale today. So if you've got an account at Citibank and I've got an account at Citibank and I transfer $100 using their app, that actually does move from my account into your account at 2 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. You don't have to wait for the Fed to be open for that movement to take place. But if you want to go from, you know, your account at Citibank to Valdana's account at JP Morgan, you've got to wait for, you know, Monday morning when the Fed wire comes back up and gets open. So I think that it would be extremely well suited there. I think that it would promote growth in crypto overall. And we would just kind of move the rails of traditional finance one step further to being digitized and efficient and modern and safe and more easily regulated, frankly.
All right, Dave. Well, we've got one tradition here. We can't let you go until we've heard the craziest thing you've seen in markets this week. But let's start with Valdana. I'm curious what Valdana's craziest thing is this week.
Well, actually, I have a question for you, Mike.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what Doja Cat and David Solomon have in common?
They're both playing Lollapalooza?
Yes. This is my craziest thing.
I'm not as out of touch as you thought, am I?
Yeah. You're in touch. You're with the cool people. So David Solomon, he's the CEO of Goldman. We learned this week he'll be performing at Lollapalooza. I think it's in July. Anyway, the most interesting thing about this and following it for a couple of years now is that, and Matt Levine at Bloomberg Opinion has written about this, is that a lot of people thought that maybe he'd have to give up his DJing side gig when he became the CEO of Goldman, but he has sort of just ignored all of that advice and he just keeps on playing. So it's amazing to me.
It's been good for his DJ career being the
yeah,
CEO of
it's been great. Goldman.
Spinner's got a spin. It's that easy.
Yeah.
So all you kids out there who are aspiring DJs, that's one way to get famous as a DJ, is just go get yourself a CEO job at one of the major Wall Street banks. That's pretty good, Valdana. I'll tip my hat to you on that one. How about you, Dave? You see anything crazy this week?
So crazy. You know, it's the LME story and the saga that continues there. Forget this week. It's one of the craziest things I've seen in my career.
Absolutely.
That a major exchange where there have been bona fide matches between buyers and sellers, no bad data feed or technology quirk gone awry or something like that, but you had the bulk of pretty much a full day of trading result in outcomes that were seen as bad, then go retroactively cancel all the trades. That is just bananas crazy.
It really is. It's one of the craziest stories of the decade, I think. Well, let me ask you, Dave, you know, is there a difference when you're talking about a physical commodity like nickel, or say if it was oil or something that's sort of, you know, important to the functioning of the global economy versus a financial asset? You know, does it kind of make sense for the LME to do that? I mean, I know everyone's mad at them and they're never going to live this down. I don't even know if they'll survive this. You know, there's so much anger towards them. But, you know, in a way, I can kind of see where they're coming from when it's, you know, when you're pushing the price of a commodity that's needed to keep sort of the global manufacturing industry rolling. Is there a distinction there? Do you think that should maybe be codified into the rules of exchanges?
So a couple reactions to that. I think especially because it's a vital commodity, that the marketplace's decision of what the right price is at where it should trade needs to be respected. And the buyer that needs nickel and is willing to pay $92,000 a ton or whatever price and has arranged themselves so that they can afford that payment because it's vital to their business, needs to know that they bought it. So I think it's probably an even heightened expectation that bona fide trades need to stand when you're talking about real world goods. You know, no less so for financial products, but I think that it's certainly the case with oil or nickel or anything else. And in the event that there are some price bans or some circuit breakers or something like that, absolutely, that is a sound market practice. Position limits should be in place, but all that needs to be done before you start trading.
You can't change the rules after
that. It's easy to say now in the rearview mirror, like, well, you know, if they had just done these three things, it would have been pretty straightforward, except for the fact that those three things are done by almost every other major commodity exchange in the world and have been for decades. But I think once you've got a trade and hedges based on that position to either save the institution or stave off other outcomes, I think you just have to kind of live with the trade and either step up and recapitalize or take the medicine and have the consequences be that other capital needs to come in, or, you know, the bad outcomes have to kind of play out. Nobody's rooting for those outcomes, but yeah, craziest thing I've seen in quite a while.
Right. And certainly no one should accept that wrapped ether for an exchange for nickel.
Yeah, you do. Give me a buzz.
All right. That's pretty good. Good answer, Dave. I like that answer. You made me rethink how I'm thinking about all this. Now, I'm going to give you my crazy thing. Vildana, are you much of a gamer? You play video games at all?
No, not at all.
Not at all. Me neither.
No, sorry.
Betting, no basketball, no video games. The amount of time that you must have available
season
in your day has got to be
I know. Astounding. She watches grammar videos on YouTube. That's her main vice.
And I sports bet during football season.
There we go.
Remember?
Oh, that's right.
On the Bills.
Only on the Bills.
That was a pretty good season for you last year then.
Thank you. Bad ending, but yeah.
Well, yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm not much of a gamer either. Back in the day, though, back in the 70s and 80s, I was pretty good. And have you ever heard of Pong, Vildana? The game Pong?
I want to say no.
This was like...
I think my dad told me about Pong.
I have a feeling Dave played a mean game of Pong.
I played a little bit of Pong. I'll admit it.
So this was probably, I think, the first video game. It was an actual arcade game. I don't know how many quarters I pumped in playing Pong. And it was really simple. It's basically video ping pong. You know, you got one line on one side of the screen that goes up and down, another line on the other screen side of the screen that goes up and down, and a ball in between. Anyway, Atari made the first home version of it. I guess they made the arcade version too, but they made the first home version of it in 1975. It sold originally under the brand name of Sears for $50. It's not bad for today's dollars. I guess that was probably pretty expensive in 1975. Anyway, the guy who created it saved one of the prototypes. So pre-manufacturers, one of the first two prototypes, and this is what they took around to Sears and whoever else and tried to sell them this video game.
This is the actual console, not the software for Pong itself, but the hardware piece.
The home console.
the box that you would buy with
the box. Yeah. And it was a hardwired circuit board. In other words, it wasn't, you know, they eventually made it with a computer chip. I think it was kind of a pretty innovative as far as computer chips and sort of accelerated the you know, development of smaller computer chips back in the day. Anyway, he sold this prototype. So, Dave, this is where we play Price is Right. What do you think the prototype for the original Pong home video game sold for at auction just recently? Valdana, you go first. What's your bid?
I'll go with 2 million. I feel like the gamer community is pretty intense.
2 million? All right, I'm going to keep a straight face.
Is that too low?
This wasn't an NFT. This is the actual device.
NFT.
You have to adjust my valuation accordingly.
10 times the actual physical good. Who knows? You could buy it and blow it up and turn that into an NFT. But what do you think? Remember, Price is Right rules are in effect, Dave.
So. Okay, so I can, if I'm over, I'm dead. I could bid $1, and if it's above 2 million, if it's below 2 million, I would win if I bid it up.
Valdana's giving you the over under, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. All right. I'm gonna take the over. I'm gonna say it's 2.1 million.
I you know what, I agree with both of you. I thought it would go for a few million. Actually, it went for $270,910.
Oh, come on.
I know. You always,
I win.
You they always assume that it's going to be some exorbitant number.
I do, yeah.
The setup, you know, the Sears story.
Exactly, the whole spiel.
Somebody should hire you the next time that they've got one of these in the block.
Yeah, but then everybody will fall asleep, then they'll wake up for the bidding process.
Ouch.
The whole story got me thinking, like, oh, this is important. This must be big. Oh, that's why he's bringing it up.
Even though you had never heard of Pong, you were still ready to bid $2 million for it.
I can picture it in my mind.
Yeah. Anyway, Dave, we'd love to get you back sometime and talk more about all this stuff. We really, really insightful conversation. And good luck to you and everyone at Jump in your endeavors.
Well, longtime listener, it's fun to be on for the first time. Would love to be back anytime I get the invite. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Valdana Hyryk is at Valdana Hyryk. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcast. What Goes Up is produced by Magnus Henriksen. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Success. It's discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel. It's where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.